Our speaker this evening is Daniel, not David, as the program unfortunately said, Daniel Kahneman. He's a graduate of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, has a PhD in psychology from the University of California at Berkeley, where he was Woodrow Wilson Fellow and University Fellow. He has been a faculty member at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem for most of the period from 1962 to 1978, interspersed with periods of research and lecturing at Harvard, University of Michigan, Cambridge, Stanford, and other institutions. Together with his wife, Dr. Anne Treisman, who was a speaker at the Institute back last winter, he was captured by the UBC Psychology Department in 1978 and is a professor of psychology here. He has done research in many areas of psychology, published a number of significant papers in the area of judgment under uncertainty and decisions under risk. This evening, he will address us on judgments and preferences, the psychology of irrationality. Dr. Kahneman.
That went off.
Better slide this up a bit. This is a very difficult operation.
Okay. I think it's all right.
Just trying to get it over. Okay.
There is a traditional view of the issue of rationality and irrationality, which has had a profound impact on our accepted images of man and of the human condition. This view pits passion against reason, the child against the adult, the immediate gratification of whims and wishes against the careful balancing of present pleasures against future pains. This view of an eternal conflict between reason and feeling pervades much of Western thought. It has been expressed in innumerable plays and novels. Indeed, the very meaning of the word irrational incorporates this notion. If you try to think of examples in which you would describe yourself as having acted irrationally, you're likely to recall cases in which a surge of emotion caused you to act against your better judgment. A case or cases in which adult faculties of deliberation and planning temporarily lost their hold on your behavior. The treatment of rationality and irrationality in terms of a conflict between passion and reason, between immediate and delayed gratification, has of course influenced the disciplines that are concerned with the study of man. Perhaps the most dramatic and most influential expression of this view is to be found in Freud's theories, in which the ego represented reason struggling precariously with the irrational forces of id and superego. In the past two or three decades, however, there has been a shift in the focus of interest and opinion among social scientists in general and among psychologists in particular in their concern with rationality and with possible sources of irrationality. Two main trends can perhaps be noted. First, there is generally less emphasis on the irrationality of man and a greater willingness to believe that people often do act reasonably and in their best interest. Second, and of greater concern to this talk, there has been a substantial change in the interpretation of such irrational behavior as does occur. Instead of attributing irrationality to a conflict between reason and passion, we are now much more inclined to trace irrational acts to deficiencies of reason itself and to limitations of the human mind. These two developments can perhaps be traced to a change in the paradigm cases that provide models for behavior. And in general, when social scientists study behavior, they think of some model situation and they extrapolate or generalize from this situation to all the rest of the universe, practically. There has been a shift from, for example, the study of neurosis to the study of economic and strategic behavior. Indeed, There had always been a large gap between the attitude of economists and psychologists to the issue of rationality, and there are now some indications that the gap could be narrowing. Economists have traditionally been rather more optimistic than psychologists about the rationality of people. There is a basic observation that plays a large role in economic theory. If the same GE toaster is prominently advertised in two neighboring stores, and if it sells for $35 in one and for $40 in the other, the more expensive store will not have many customers. In this elementary situation, then, most people appear to behave rationally. Much economic analysis is based on the assumption that rationality also prevails in more complex situations. Indeed, the theory of rational choice, to which I shall later compare actual choices, represents an attempt to generalize this notion of rationality from elementary choices to complex ones. Whether or not they accept the notion that people are as rational as economists sometimes would like to propose, psychologists who study economic choices typically end up with more respect for people's ability to act in their best interest than was the case, say, in the Freudian tradition. So much for the first theme. And perhaps this theme could be summarized as saying that people are not as irrational as was once believed. The second theme, however, involves questioning the very assumption that people always make rational choices regardless of the complexity of the problem that confronts them. Now, this assumption, which had been made for convenience in much economic analysis, was questioned by one of the few giants of the social sciences, Herbert Simon, who received the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1978, although he is not, strictly speaking, an economist. Simon introduced in the 1950s a concept of bounded rationality, suggesting that irrationality often results from an inability to figure out an optimal course of action, rather than from a person yielding to a surge of uncontrollable impulse. My remarks today will be concerned with bounded rationality. I come to this problem as a cognitive psychologist with an interest in delineating the boundaries of what people can and cannot do, and in providing a description of people's mental capacity and their limitations. Specifically, I shall mention three areas in which cognitive limitations appear to affect the rationality of choices, and I shall attempt to provide a sense of what a more detailed and technical analysis of these areas looks like. We were warned that there is a problem. Okay. That's it. I think that's okay.
How would you like to hold it?
Yeah, I'll hold it if it's... I'll try this. Okay. The main questions of concern will be, how do people conceive of decision situations? Do they construe decision situations appropriately? In particular, how do people view the most common and at the same time the most complex decisions in which one must choose among a set of alternative options without knowing with certainty what the consequences would follow any one of these possible options? The second question will be, in effect, a continuation of the first. Since most interesting problems of choice involve considerable uncertainty, we can ask, what about people's ability to evaluate the odds that they face? And one aspect of bounded rationality concerns people's ability to assess probabilities, to make predictions, and to evaluate what in fact will be the consequences of possible courses of action. And the third question with which we'll be concerned will be possible trade-offs between risks and values. Now, what I'll be doing in each of these three areas follows a similar pattern. I will mention something about what the normative or prescriptive analysis consists of. That is, what theorists who study rational decisions prescribe as rational behavior. And I'll try to outline the possible contrast between the prescribed or normative analysis and the intuitions that people normally bring to bear to these situations. So what I shall do is I'll attempt to compare what people think and what they do about situations of decision and choice to a so-called normative or prescriptive model of what a rational person should think and do in such situations. Now, a comparison of what people do to what they ought to do appropriately begins with a consideration of how decision problems are viewed. It usually comes as a surprise, and this itself is significant, I believe, that the theory of decisions takes the choice of one of several offered lottery tickets as a paradigm, a general paradigm for most of decision making. Now, the reason for this choice in the theory is quite simple. Most important decisions must be made without complete information about their consequences. We marry without knowing how we or our partner will change in personality or in taste. We take a job without knowing what could happen to the people in the institution that we join. Think, for example, of a university student in the process of deciding between engineering and law, or of a recent graduate choosing among several job offers. It is simply a fact that such a person neither knows nor can know the consequences that will follow from the choice that will be made. Every option can then be compared to a lottery ticket, which may offer a certain probability of bliss, a certain probability of disaster, and probabilities for intervening states. And when one chooses one of the options, one of the jobs, whether or not to marry, one chooses such a lottery ticket with all the uncertainties that it involves. Now, it is a significant observation, I believe, that people generally find this comparison surprising, perhaps even a little shocking. They do not much like the view of life as a succession of choices among lottery tickets. It seems that such a view rather detracts from the coherence of our image of the world and makes any choice as good as any other. At any rate, this is very frequently the reaction. However, this, I believe, is completely wrong. Even when we choose among lottery tickets, there are choices that are good and others that are inferior. A theory of rational decision would help us identify the best ticket in the offered set and would prescribe that we always choose that ticket. Unfortunately, for any simple view of the world, however, the best decision need not always produce the best outcome. And let us carefully consider one example. Consider, for example, the following choice. A die will be thrown, and you're offered a choice of two bets. Bet A is the following. You win $100 if the die shows 1, 2, 3, or 4. You win nothing if the die shows 5 or 6. Bet B. You win $100 if the die shows 5 or 6. You win nothing otherwise. Now consider two individuals. Say Mr. Smith and Mrs. Smith. Mr. Smith prefers bet B, the one where you win on 5 or 6. Mrs. Smith prefers bet A, where you win on 1 through 4. Who is right? Now, obviously, Mrs. Smith is right. There is, in this choice between two lotteries, a correct decision. And the decision that provides the better odds of winning is the correct decision. Notice, however, that the correct decision need not involve the best outcome. Imagine that Mr. and Mrs. Smith have both made their choice. The die is tossed, is thrown. It shows 6. Mr. Smith has won. The outcome, then, is better for Mr. Smith than for Mrs. Smith. Who was right? Who made the correct decision? Now, we must realize, and this is a preliminary to any rational view of decision-making, that it is still true that Mrs. Smith made the correct decision, although the outcome worked out rather badly for her and much better for Mr. Smith, who made the wrong decision. Now, the fact that this is not intuitive is, I think, fairly important. It is an absolutely crucial assumption in the analysis of rational decision that the quality of a decision can only be evaluated in terms of the odds that were perceived or that were available when the choice was made. Now, it is quite conceivable and indeed inevitable that correct decisions will frequently lead to disastrous outcomes, while incorrect decisions will be unjustly rewarded, as was the case in our example. Whether we like it or not, this state of affairs must be accepted if we first accept the basic fact that options among which we choose are just like lottery tickets. Now, this obvious postulate of decision theory, that good decisions do not necessarily produce good outcomes, is extremely strange to most people's intuitions. And therein lies an important cause for much irrational behavior in both the personal and the public domain. Even in the context of obvious gambles, it is only rather grudgingly that we admit that Mrs. Smith made the right decision if we know that she lost. In other contexts, we rarely even attempt to properly distinguish the quality of decisions from the quality of outcomes to which these decisions lead. Now, I've been interested in this particular question for a long time, and I'll sort of in collecting examples in which the lack of a distinction between decision and outcome is most glaring. Now, one of my all-time favorites is a sentence which appeared in Time magazine all the way back in 1970 when Nixon made the decision to invade Cambodia. And Time magazine had the following statement about this particular decision. And it said, Mr. Nixon has taken a gamble, and only history will tell whether it was a mistake. Now, I would hope to convince you that this statement, which sounds very intuitive and in fact quite innocuous, displays a pernicious sort of illiteracy about decision making. Nixon's decision to invade Cambodia may have been correct or incorrect, just or unjust, from a strategic or from a moral point of view. Whatever it was, however, it was when it was made. A decision does not become a mistake, nor does it become immoral for that matter, because of its consequences. Now, contrary to the precepts of decision theory, the practice of evaluating decisions largely by their outcomes is almost universal. We find it in the moral domain. You probably noticed that we are much more lenient toward an inept would-be murderer who shoots and misses than toward another one who is just unlucky enough to be a good shot. So, in the context of decision-making, the judgments that we pass on decisions, our own and those of others, including those of political leaders, are very largely based on outcomes and not, as would be proper, on a serious attempt to evaluate the quality of the process by which the decision was reached. In dealing with gambles, we may grudgingly admit that Mrs. Smith was right, although Mr. Smith won the bet, but we do not typically extend this charity to other decision makers in real life. How is this phenomenon to be explained? Now, the issue is complex, and there is more than one reason for the discrepancy between the common view of decisions and that which is prescribed by decision theory and by the analysis of rationality in decision making. One important contributing factor is, perhaps, that we have a strong tendency to deny the reality of uncertainty. And this tendency to deny the reality of uncertainty is supported by a great facility for hindsight. Now, typically, we would judge Nixon as if he should have known what the consequences of his gamble would be. That is, we typically evaluate decisions as if the actor, the decision maker, had known ahead of time what the decisions, how the gamble would come out. Now, so we look at any particular case, forgetting that the decision was made without knowledge as to what the consequences would be. What seems to be happening could be described as follows. We seem to believe that the handwriting must have been on the wall all the time, plain for the decision maker to see. Now, in fact, of course, It is often the case that whatever handwriting was on the wall, it was an invisible ink. And it is only the occurrence of the event that makes the handwriting apparent, or so glaringly apparent to all of us. This is the phenomenon of hindsight, a phenomenon by which any event that occurs tend to appear retrospectively almost inevitable. Now, this phenomenon has been extensively studied by one of my former student and associates, Baruch Fischoff, and among other situations in which he studied insight, he presented people with vignettes from historical texts describing a particular historical situation in which a decision was made. For example, a situation of unrest in India in which a decision was made to send the Gurkhas in to suppress a potential rebellion. And what he did, he presented people with a series of possible outcomes for this problem and asked them to evaluate the probabilities of these outcomes after providing them with a considerable amount of background information about what the situation was when the decision was made. And people did that. Other groups of subjects were presented with the same story. They were also told what the outcome had been, except that different groups of subjects were told different outcomes. Some that the attempt to send the Gurkhas in had been successful, and others that it had failed, etc. And these groups were also asked to assess the probabilities of the various outcomes as it had been, as that probability should have been judged when the decision was made. Now, the significant finding of this study was that subjects, in spite of their great desire to obey the instructions, were simply incapable of doing so. When you know what the outcome was, the probability of that outcome appears inflated in spite of the best and most honest attempts to try to think yourself or to work yourself into the frame mind of it, into a frame of mind in which you ignore what actually happened. So hindsight seems to be a very basic phenomenon which has pernicious consequences for our approach to decision making. And this happens, I think, in several ways. First, hindsight tends to reinforce and to perpetuate the tendency to deny the existence and the reality of uncertainty. After the fact, we can explain almost anything that happened. And therefore, retrospectively, as we rewrite history, we see very little uncertainty in the course of events. And therefore, when we look forward, we believe that whatever uncertainty there is should not be there, is somehow unreal, and that a leader with real flair, a decision maker with great perspicacity, ought to be able somehow to divine the future. In fact, it is simply an obvious fact of the human situation that most decisions have to be made without such knowledge, and that it is simply impossible to take up a crystal ball, gaze into it, and divine what the future will be. So that this identification of options and decision-making with lottery tickets is inevitable, although somehow we tend to reject it, and although the phenomenon of hindsight tends to lead us always to reject it. Another effect of hindsight, I think, is that it tends to make us rather less charitable towards decision makers than we normally ought to be. Decision makers get relatively little credit for good outcomes, because if the outcomes are good, then this appears to have been an obvious choice that was made. However, they tend to get pilloried when the outcomes are bad because of hindsight, because they should have known that the outcome was going to be bad. And so this phenomenon of hindsight, which appears to be irresistible by the best evidence, that people simply cannot control this retrospective adjustment of all past events towards inevitability, this phenomenon appears to present a serious obstacle to rational thinking about decisions. Now, ultimately, deficiencies in the evaluations of decision makers are costly to the public that decision makers are supposed to serve. And this is for the following reason. It is frequently possible for a decision maker to adopt a hindsight avoidance strategy. That is, there are in many decisions, in many choice problems, one of the courses of action is likely to be hindsight proof. That is, it is such an action where even if things come out badly, it might not be your fault, or it might not retrospectively appear to have been your fault. Frequently, however, hindsight avoidance strategies are not in the best interest of the community, and they lead to decisions which are systematically inferior. And so a lack of charity to leaders and a lack of empathy for the fact that decision makers face a problem of uncertainty tends, in the long run, I think, to run against the interest of the community and, in fact, ultimately, to reduce the rationality of decision-making instead of serving it. Now, I have gone into some detail in the discussion of hindsight to illustrate a type of irrationality which stems from what I would call an imperfection of reasoning. It does not stem from the intensity of passion. What I have tried to illustrate in both these cases, both the notion of hindsight and the difficulty of discriminating the quality of outcomes from the quality of decision, is that the problem here, I think, is a problem for the cognitive psychologist rather than for the student of emotions. What I have also tried to do is, I hope, to appeal to your own intuition. And in the sense that if there is anything that was surprising in what I have been describing, it was my description of what the normative and prescriptive model ought to be. It was certainly not my description of what people normally do and of the way that we normally think about decision making. I hope that I have accurately characterized what the standard intuition is, and whatever surprise you may have found was in the contrast between the standard intuition and the way the decision theorist view the problem of rational decision making. Now, another characteristic flaw in the intuitive approach to decisions is illustrated in the following example, which I'll just read. Mr. Paul owns shares in Company A. Now, during the past year, he considered switching to stock in Company B, but decided against it. He now finds that he would have been better off by $1,200 if he had switched to the stock of Company B. Mr. George owns shares in Company B. During the past year, he switched to stock in Company A. He now finds that he would have been better off by $1,200 if he had kept his stock in Company B. The question is, who of the two feels greater regret? Now, there is an obvious answer. Although Mr. Paul and Mr. George are both poorer by exactly $1,200 than they could have been if they had made a different choice, we do not expect them to be equally upset. And there is a very clear answer. We expect, Mr. George, the one who switched to stock in Company A, the second one, to be considerably more upset than Mr. Paul. Indeed, I don't know. We haven't done a study to compare who is more upset, but we have done studies to check whether this difference between them is as obvious to everybody as it is, at least to me, and it is. And there is clearly a stereotype. And what this stereotype reveals here is a major difference, I think a striking asymmetry, between our treatment of action and inaction. I mean, the difference between those two individuals is that both of them considered a decision. Both of them eventually made a decision. One made the decision not to switch stock, and he is now poorer by $1,200 than he could have been. The other made a decision to act, to switch stock, and he is now poorer by $1,200 than he could have been. One of them acted, the other failed to act. And the asymmetry that we see is an asymmetry between action and inaction, between commission and omission. Now, this asymmetric treatment of action and inaction that we perceive in regret naturally tends to favor inaction. And this is a very general observation. There seems to be almost a maxim when it comes down to the notion of regret that when in doubt, abstain. because there will be less regret associated with possibly negative consequences if you fail to act than if you do act. This type of conservative rule, it should be mentioned, has often been attributed to bureaucrats and to conservative organizations generally. But the point that I'm trying to make is that it seems to be built right into our own intuitions. We do treat omission and commission very differently, and this is in the structure of the intuitions, and it does absolutely defy the rules of any attempt to analyze rational decision making. This defies rationality. According to any normative or prescriptive analysis of this problem, if you consider two options, the distinction between acting and not acting is a relatively inconsequential one, which should not have any major impact on your choice, and it is in some sense illegitimate to have or to associate different degrees of regret with two decisions which in that sense ought to be treated symmetrically. In many cases, by the way, the fear of regret and the fear of hindsight tend to reinforce one another and to act in the same direction, both favoring inaction. That is, it is very commonly the case that when we take an action, we act, we have a clearer view of what would have happened if we had just refrained. Sometimes it's an illusion, but it's a very common illusion. Typically, though, when we fail to act, it's harder for us to be absolutely sure of what the situation would have been if we had positively changed circumstances. So in that sense, both hindsight, the fear of hindsight and regret, typically reinforce one another, and both reinforce the choice of inaction over the choice of action. Now notice that in the analysis that I have provided so far, there has been relatively little appeal to emotion. And even when I have discussed the emotion of regret, and it is surely an emotion, I have discussed it in terms of its cognitive determinants. That is, what I have said, in effect, is that there is an asymmetry between action and inaction, which probably stems from the fact that we find it much easier to think of a positive action as causing the outcome. We find it relatively hard to think of a failure to act as a cause of anything. And it is this bias, which is mainly a cognitive bias in our causal thinking, which appears to be associated with a major bias in our evaluation of action versus inaction, commission versus omission. And this, in turn, represents a substantial violation of the basic tenets of rational decision-making. So much, then, for the first topic and the one about which I was going to be most explicit. I have two others about which I would like to talk a little more briefly. One is, how do we assess the odds? Now, the description of the decision problem, which I have provided, identifies the decision problem as a choice between lottery tickets. Except that, in real life, of course, the lottery tickets are not specified. We have another task. And our task is somehow to provide an estimate or to generate our own estimate as to the quality of the lottery. But as there is no one to tell us whether the probability of bliss and the probability of disaster or of intervening states, this is a judgment that somehow we must make. Now, it therefore becomes appropriate, if one studies bounded rationality, to raise the question of how well people do in assessing the odds that face them, how well people do in predicting the outcomes of their actions, and in general, in predicting the outcomes in uncertain situations. Now, this has been a very active focus of research in cognitive psychology, at least for the past 10 years. A final verdict on the capacity of people is certainly not in. The preliminary results, however, are not really terribly encouraging. It turns out that when people's ability to think and to make predictions about future events is carefully compared to what it ought to be, and I will explain in a few minutes what I mean by ought to be, that in general, intuitive predictions turn out to have extremely severe deficiencies, and that the problem of assessing the odds, the problem of conceiving what is the nature of the lottery ticket among which we have to choose, seems to be quite a formidable one for most people. By the way, for experts probably as well as for laymen, and this is an issue to which I'll have occasion to return. In order to illustrate this, I would like to start by a personal anecdote. A few years ago, as a matter of fact, this is not entirely irrelevant, I think somewhere about 5 years ago, I was involved in, or began to be involved in, a project in which we were going to write a textbook for high schools about judgment under uncertainty. And there was a team of us working, psychologists and students of decision making and experts in education. And we worked for quite a while and sort of developed fairly detailed plans about how we're going to operate. And after we'd been at it for about a year, we decided what our course of action would be, and our course of action was going to be to write a textbook. And we decided to run the exercise and to estimate how long it was going to take us to write this particular textbook. And there were, I think, about 8 of us in the table, and I ran that and I asked everybody to jot down what their estimate was. And there was considerable agreement among us, myself included, by the way, that we would probably manage between 2 and 3 years. And there was also considerable agreement in the manner that we, in the process by which we reached this estimate. And we reached this estimate by planning. That is, we had an idea of how things ought to go if they went well. We were also wise enough, we thought, to realize that things do not always go well, so we added a substantial margin of safety, and therefore we said that it would probably take 3 years for a project that really ought to take rather less than that. At that point, I had an idea, and the idea was to ask people another question. And the other question, which was addressed specifically to the education experts among us who had just produced that estimate, was the following. Can you think of other examples of projects like ours? That is, where a group of people, a fairly heterogeneous group of people, gets together in an attempt to write a textbook in a completely new subject for which no textbook exists. What, in fact, has been the fate of similar groups? And the dean of education at Hebrew University was a member of the group, and he came up with the first estimate. And this is, for me, rather an unforgettable moment. He thought for a minute, and he said, well, I can think of quite a number of similar cases, and the situation in the following. First, most of them never got there. Most of them failed. Second, those that made it, made it in a duration that was between 5 and 9 years. I cannot think of any example in which a project of this nature took less than 5 years. Now, what I would like to emphasize here is the following. There seems to be in this anecdote, and I think it is illustrative of a great deal of intuitive thinking in situations of uncertainty, there seems to be a rather striking contrast between two views of the same problem. The problem being, how long will it take to complete a particular project? There is an inside view, and the inside view is full of detail about what is intended and what is desired and what the obstacles are, and it's extremely specific and extremely precise and very frequently completely wrong. Then there is an outside view, and the outside view is fundamentally different. It really looks at the case as an example of a broader class of similar cases, and it asks questions in a sequence that in fact is a prescribed sequence. And let me describe the sequence to you of what proper or rational, if you will, decision or thinking ought to be in a problem of this kind. And there is a sequence. The sequence might be as follows. The first question is, what are similar problems? What is the range of times, of durations for completion of projects? The first question. Okay. We are told most of them fail. Those that succeed take between 5 and 9 years. Let's say the average is 7 years. Then there is a next question. Let us look at our project relative and compare our project as it looks now to other projects as they looked at a similar stage in their development. Do we look better or worse than the average project? I mean, do we have any special sort of strength that would make it very likely that we're going to do vastly better than most other projects? Do we have any special weaknesses that would make it very likely that we're going to do much worse than most projects? Our first estimate ought to be somewhere around the average of the class of similar projects. And you can work it from there. I mean, there is a sequence of steps wherein you can utilize information that is available to you about similar projects and analyze a particular problem, not from the inside, but rather from the outside. Now, there are several points to be made about this comparison of the inside view and of the outside view. First, we can note that the outside view is sometimes adopted by people. Typically, it is adopted in problems which are recognized to be repetitive. Weather forecasters, when their thought processes have been analyzed, are the typical outside view people. They can see any instance as a class, as a member of a class of similar instances. Some business decision makers, where fairly repetitive decisions are frequently made, tend to adopt an outside view of problems and to view a problem as a member of a class of similar problems. Some medical judgments are made from an outside view. There are other problems which are typically made with an inside view. Unfortunately, and several things I think ought to be said about those problems to which inside views are normally applied. First, they are frequently the more important ones. The most important decisions, the strategic kind of decisions that are made, both I think by the individual and certainly in the public domain, are one-of-a-kind decisions, which frequently are very difficult to match to a case. And even if they can be matched to a case, people do not do so. I'll come back to that in a minute. So the strategic decisions, the crucial decisions, the unique decisions typically lead to the adoption of an inside view. And instead of trying to look at them as representatives, as members of a broader class and to take a long view of them, we try to work our way inside the details of the problem and to focus on the unique features of the problem in an attempt to divine the outcome. Okay, what happens when we compare the inside view to the outside view? The first point is very clear. The inside view typically leads to much less accurate judgments. And a striking example, I think this is why I brought it, of course, is the one with which I began, in which the collective judgment of a reasonably intelligent group of people about how long it would take to complete a project was outside the range of experience. That is, we thought it would be 2 or 3 years, where in fact the best guess was that we would fail, and if not that, that the project would take at least 7 years. By the way, it's been 5 years, and it might perhaps be completed in a year or two. So the outside view was certainly correct in this particular case. There was no way we could have done it in 3 years. Now, another point, which is, I think, of importance, is that the inside view of problems is frequently adopted by people. It's preferred, in fact, even when the individual has available to him enough information to adopt an outside view. And the example that I brought has that feature too. The dean of the School of Education, who was sitting with us providing an estimate and had estimated that we would take about 2.5 years to finish that book, had available to him somewhere in his memory the store of information about similar projects. That information never seemed relevant. It, in fact, was not brought to bear in his thinking on the issue because he was taking the inside view. And typically, this will be the case. When we have a great deal of detail about a particular problem, we will prefer to take the inside view, although it is, in general, less accurate. So in this instance, what do we have? We have a bias of human thinking. We have, I think, a bias in intuition, which, quite commonly, may lead to the adoption of, well, it may lead to making profoundly incorrect decisions. And at least in this respect, and this is one of many about which the same could be said, people do not fare terribly well when we evaluate their performance as assessors of the lottery tickets which they face. Now, what I would like to emphasize here is that the rational model to which I have compared intuitive performance, and in this comparison, intuitive performance was found wanting, this rational model does not require necessarily statistical sophistication, nor does it require information that is not there, that is not available to the individual. We could failure of intelligence or of not having the information. It is a failure to use information appropriately when that information is, in fact, ready to be used. There are other features of intuitive judgment which have been studied in the past decade and which lead to similarly pessimistic, I think, conclusions about the quality of intuition. A major finding that has been replicated a number of times has been that people are tremendously overconfident in their judgments of probability. And in some sense, are very poor judges of the extent of their own ignorance. The studies, the prototypical studies in which this has been demonstrated, are carried out in the following way, and they started out at the Harvard Business School, actually, in a classic work about 10 years ago. Well, if you want to test or to have fun with people, it's almost a parlor game, in fact. You can pick some quantities arbitrarily from any almanac, like the number of, telephones in Canada, or the air distance between New Delhi and Peking, or any of those odd facts that you can find about an almanac. Now, if you try to think about the air distance between New Delhi and Peking, you will find that this is a fairly typical problem in some sense. Not that it's in most others, but there is a sense in which it is typical, and this is that you know something about the problem. You are very unlikely to know the correct answer, but you know that it's certainly more than a couple of hundred miles, and certainly, or almost certainly, or is it, less than 10,000? So there are bounds within which this quantity lies, and it is possible for a judge to assess these bounds. Now, one question that you can put, for example, you can request people to choose a number for the distance between New Delhi and Peking, which would be a high estimate. And a high estimate would be defined as follows. It ought to be a number such that you're 99% sure that that number is too high. Not 100%, 99%. So you ought to view the odds in your favor, if you were to bet that the number is less than that, as 99 to 1, or you ought to be willing to take a 1 against 100 shot that the number will in fact be higher. It's a feasible task, at least it is for students at the Harvard Business School, and it has been found feasible for many others. And this game has been played hundreds of times in many laboratories because the phenomenon that it yields very reliably is a quite fascinating one. We can now, in the next phase of this game, define a surprise. And a surprise would be defined as follows. if the unexpected event occurs, that is, if the distance between New Delhi and Peking is even higher than your high estimate, let's call that a surprise. Now we can play this game many times on many quantities, many air distances and number of telephones in Canada and other questions, etc. And we can ask, how frequent are the surprises? That is, how frequently does an event occur which we have judged so unlikely that we assign a 1 in 100 probability to it? And the answer, quite reliably, is about 20% of the time. That is, the rate of surprises in games of this type, and many variants of this game have been played, the rate of surprises at the 1% level is somewhere between 15 and 25%. Now, what this means is that people, in some sense, must somehow know less than they think. And that people have considerable difficulty in assessing, at least, or in expressing in this particular manner, how little they know about problems such as the air distance between New Delhi and Peking and many other problems of similar class. Now, when we are thinking of decision-making, both in the private and the public domain, decision-making involves thinking about uncertain events. It involves somehow assessing what is the extreme range of events that could be encountered. The evidence available so far seems to indicate that we're not likely to do terribly well in this situation, and specifically, that any person who has an opinion about things is likely to be too sure of his or her opinion. And the data on this point are strong and I think reasonably alarming, particularly because there seems to be no real relation between expertise and the degree to which we become good judges of our ignorance. And let me explain this a little bit. There are situations, like, for example, weather forecasting or repetitive situations, where people, in fact, become quite good at assessing the probabilities of events. However, in other situations which are somehow similar, like political decision making, where any decision is treated as unique, people, as they develop experience, also develop a great deal of confidence in their ability to guess what the system will do in any one situation. What seems to be suggested by studies of this topic is that as people's ability to guess systems improves, their confidence in their ability to guess improves even faster. And if they were overconfident to begin with, they remain overconfident as their ability improves. And they frequently become even more overconfident. That is, quite frequently it happens that people think there is more expertise to be had than in fact exists. And a very striking effect about political decision making, for example, is that there seems to be a ceiling to the level of precision that can be achieved in political forecast or in strategic forecast. And it does not take very much to reach that ceiling. That is, in studies that have been carried out comparing people at different levels of sophistication in regional forecasts of political, military, or strategic events, the level of sophistication at which the ability to predict or to forecast reached its peak, and the peak is low, the level of sophistication was itself not very high. That is, what experts seem to be superbly good at is in explaining events that have occurred, in developing theories about and models of the situation. They are not terribly good at predicting discontinuities. They are not terribly good at predicting those uncertain events about which, in general, decision makers are most concerned. Here again, then, there appears to be a limitation of some kind on people's ability to think under uncertainty, and this limitation cannot be terribly helpful to achieve rational decision making. Let me finally deal very briefly with one last point. And this is, what is our attitude, what is the common attitude to risks and to probabilities? And do we have an attitude towards risk and towards probabilities of danger, which would be considered rational by a theory of rational decision making? And the answer is very clearly, we do not. There is a major gap between the intuitive attitudes and the intuitive preferences that people have about risks and dangers, and in fact about benefits as well, but specifically about hazards, and the attitude that would seem to be warranted in terms of a theory of rational decision. Let me explain. Consider a nuclear reactor, and consider a risk of meltdown. Now, in the first place, what you probably notice is that you don't want to consider a risk of meltdown. And there is a reluctance to admit that such a risk exists or should be allowed to exist. The experts, of course, know that some risk is absolutely inevitable. If there is going to be a nuclear reactor, there is going to be a risk of meltdown. Now, imagine that that risk of meltdown has been assessed by experts. And suppose that that risk is, 3 in a million of a meltdown occurring in a particular reactor within a specified time frame, say 10 years. Now think of how much the government should be willing to pay to reduce that risk, say, to 2 in a million. And you might have some impression of a number. Now consider another problem, and assume, for example, that the risk to begin with is 1 in a million, and that you have an opportunity to reduce that risk to 0. How much should the government be willing to pay to reduce the risk from 1 in a million to 0? Should the cost that we, as a society, should pay for such improvements be the same? Should it be different? What should we pay more for? There is a reasonably clear answer, I think, to be derived from an analysis of rational decision making. And this is that the two situations should be treated alike. And that the value of a 1 in a million improvement or reduction in the risk of a meltdown is the same, regardless of whether we start from 3 in a million or from 1 in a million. It is absolutely clear from studies of people's preferences about situations of uncertainty that this particular conclusion is very counterintuitive. People view the reduction from 1 in a million to 0 as much more valuable than the reduction from 3 in a million to 2 in a million. This is extremely pernicious. There seems to be an asymmetry in our attitude to what might be called insurance, the elimination of risk, and to what might be called protective action, the reduction of changes of chances of risk. And we seem, by and large, both as individuals and as societies, much more willing to pay for insurance than we are for a comparable improvement that expresses itself as a probabilistic improvement in terms of protective action and as a reduction in the magnitude of a risk. This is an extremely prevalent attitude, and it leads to very obviously irrational choices, because, in fact, the two situations are quite frequently undistinguishable. To dramatize this a bit, I will end with a study or description of a study that was recently done on this problem. And you can match your intuitions against the intuitions of the subjects which face the following questions. The subjects were told that to consider a threatened epidemic of the flu. And this particular flu, they were told, involves well, roughly a week in bed with chills, aches, etc. Furthermore, imagine that it has been scientifically assessed that your chances of getting that flu are 10%. Now, a vaccine is available, which is fully effective and would reduce your probability of getting that flu from 10% to zero. That's problem number one. In problem number two, the situation is the following. There is the flu. The flu has been described in the same way. Your probability of getting the flu is 20%. There is a vaccine. The vaccine is not fully effective. It reduces your probability of getting the flu from 20% to 10%. And now you can begin to compare whether you would be equally willing to take the vaccine under both conditions. Now consider the following problem. There is a threatened epidemic of the flu. Two viruses are involved, virus A and virus B. Now, both viruses cause the same symptoms. You spend a week in bed with chills and aches. Now, there is a vaccine that is available which is fully effective against virus A. It is not at all effective against virus B. Would you like to have this vaccine? Now, I am appealing to your intuitions here and suggesting that if you are like most other people, then your intuitions are probably the following. You found the first vaccine very attractive. That's a vaccine. It reduces, you know, it's one what wants a vaccine to do. It reduces your probability of getting a disease from 10% to zero. Fine. You did not find the second very attractive. 20% to 10% somehow seems worth rather less. You like the third one a lot better, or at least that's what most people do, because it provides fully effective protection against one type of vaccine, and that in fact is what vaccines normally do. But now notice that the second problem and the third are strictly identical. In both cases, you initially have a 20% chance of spending a week in bed with chills and aches. And by taking the vaccine, you reduce this probability to 10%. Why on earth, then, should you find the third vaccine more attractive than the second? And yet most people very clearly do, and that study has been replicated in several variants, and it seems to work quite consistently. What seems to be happening is that we have a sort of magic about certainty. And that magic is very clearly expressed in this case, it's associated to a name. That is, we are certainly and fully protected against a virus of type A. And although we couldn't tell the difference between having flu type A and flu type B, we like the feeling that there is one risk against which we're completely protected. This is the kind of failure of rationality which does not, I think, arise from emotions. It does not arise from passions. It arises, as I think Simon suggested, from bounded rationality, from the limitations of the human mind. And we are so built that having the correct preferences, having preferences that fit a rational analysis of the situation, does not come very naturally to us. What implications could be drawn from this tale, which has not been terribly positive, although I would wish to emphasize that I do not think, you know, that there is room for that much gloom either. As I have said, in fact, the general trend has been to a growing respect for human capacities, although most of the stories that I have told you apply a grain of salt, you know, to that respect. What should be done? What could be done? I think there are two directions that we might want to think about if we are concerned with the general problem of rationality. One is we probably ought to be very seriously concerned about mechanisms in which decisions are made in society. And we ought to be concerned with what might be called the human engineering of decision making, by which I mean fitting decision making mechanisms and procedures to the recognized limitations of human intuitions and human judgment. This is a task that is, in some sense, yet to be performed. The institutions by which decisions are normally made have not been designed in an attempt to circumvent the deficiencies of human intuition and the irrationalities or inconsistencies of human preferences. There is, of course, another point. And the other point has something to do with education. What I have suggested, what I have tried to describe, is a series of apparent conflicts between an intuitive way, an intuitive view of problems, and the view of problems that is suggested by a slightly more thorough but not extremely sophisticated analysis of the same problem. It might be worth thinking of, well, that citizens in a democracy need to be educated about the deficiencies of their intuitions concerning decision making, and that it is an important part of the role of a citizen to be able to recognize what decisions are. I would consider it an important educational objective to have citizens who can evaluate the quality of the decision making to which they are subjected. And in order to do that, well, perhaps a new discipline would have to be established, and certainly some new textbooks would have to be written. Thank you.
Time for some questions. I'll remind you, your question should be brief, and would you, if you're at the back, project your voice so that we can hear you up here. I'll ask Dr. Kahneman to repeat each question before answering it so the whole hall knows what's going on. Are there any questions?
Yes, the left and right hemisphere, do they come into this process somewhere along the line?
Not that I know. No. The question was whether the left and right hemispheres come into this somewhere down the line, I don't know. There are stories to this effect that one of them is more rational than the other, but I don't know enough about it. Yes?
There are ways of developing intuition, I believe, such as following punches, developing contact with subconscious, through dreams, through self-fulfillment, meditation and prayer, which would seem to indicate that we can do something toward more successful personal decision making.
The suggestion is advanced that there are ways of promoting or improving intuition through meditation, prayer, and whether I have any comments to offer. I do not know of any serious scientific study of the effects of meditation and prayer in improving the quality of judgment in the kind of problems with which I've been concerned here. There are possibly classes of problems where intuitions could be substantially altered by the kind of intervention that you have in mind. And these have to do with our ability to predict our own preferences, our own choices, and somehow to discern our own wishes. People are often very weak, not only in predicting how other systems will develop, but in assessing what they want and how they will feel or are likely to feel in one or another situation. So I certainly would not want to rule out the possibility that there is room for improvement there by that type of program. I am rather skeptical of the possibility of improving people's ability to people's intuitions or general intuitions about in situations of uncertainty by this kind of intervention. The experiments, however, have simply not been done.
Is it possible that information or probability can be put into a computer and eventually a computer can be used as a help in making decisions? Or do you think that the inner decision, intuition, could still be the best decision?
The question is, do we expect computers to soon replace decision makers, making the question of intuition irrelevant? I'm reminded of a comment by one of my teachers, late Professor Yoshua Bar Hillel, who was discussing the issue of whether computers would ever understand language. And in a very famous remark, he said, I confidently assert that computers will never understand language, by which I mean at least for the next 10 years. But I think that at least for the next 10 years, and in fact probably for a great deal longer, computers will play a relatively inconsequential role, I think, in most significant decision-making. I mean, computers are enormously helpful in many forecasting tasks. I mean, they help in forecasting the weather and they help in economic forecasting. They are not that helpful, for example, in political forecasting, which is possibly more important. And it is extremely difficult to imagine a situation in which computers will be very much more important in crucial strategic decision-making than just as note-taking. I don't think that this is the case at the moment, anywhere. Yes? I don't think I understood your question very well. Could you repeat that a little? Which, I haven't enumerated them, so, yeah. I'm having difficulties with your voice. What I would suggest on this, could we try that later? And because since I can't understand you, I'm running into trouble. Any other questions? Yes.
Do you think that the overconfidence people have survival value?
Does overconfidence have survival value? I don't know. The question is, of course, how would we live, how would we feel if we really accepted the amount of uncertainty in which we have to feel, and is this a useful defense, the denial of uncertainty? Was that what you had in mind? I don't know. I think I wouldn't want to commit myself, saying that it would be an unmitigated boon, to be able to assess the odds that they really are. I have a slightly different attitude for myself, say, and for decision makers who act on my behalf. I really do not care about their happiness. That is, I certainly would want anybody who acts on my behalf or whose actions affect me to have as good an estimate of the odds as are available. And there is a real problem there. I think the question has been heard. Are the bounds of rationality culture dependent? The bounds with which, well, let's put it this way. I don't think there is very good evidence. Cross-cultural evidence on attitudes to uncertainty is really scanty. However, the following could be said. In general, an analysis, a psychological analysis, has been offered for most cases in which bounded rationality has been observed. That is, for the difficulties of people to appreciate uncertainty, say. It is possible to suggest a mechanism which makes this outcome inevitable. So my impression is that most of what I have said is built in so deep into the very machinery of our thinking that I would expect it to be cross-culturally valid. But I cannot say that there is evidence. That is, this would follow necessarily if the theory that I would use to explain some of these effects is valid. But there is no direct experimental evidence that I'm aware of. I do not really believe the first observation. I mean, we all know we are going to die and we all go on. And I do not think that it would make a qualitative difference to know when we were going to. It strikes me that if we adjust to the fact of death, then we would adjust to the date as well. There is a comment made about Mr. Trudeau's overconfidence in economic matters. I certainly have nothing to say about that.
I think before we move on to all the political leaders, that this would be an appropriate moment to ask Dr. Peter Sudfeld, head of the psychology department, to thank our speaker on behalf of the Institute.
It has been said of experimental psychologists that the greater the degree to which their work is characterized by empirical rigor and theoretical elegance, the lesser the degree to which people who know about it think it's personally relevant and useful. I think Professor Kleiman is one of the few exceptions to that, and one of the very few exceptions who is consistently in violation of that rule. I think today, for instance, there are three things in particular for which I'm grateful. One is that he has enabled us to perhaps understand better the way in which we make decisions. Second, he has given us some guidelines for how we can improve those decisions. And I think perhaps, given the nature of the world, the most important is that he has enabled us to think that our decisions were correct, even if they turn out to have disastrous consequences.
Next week, Dr. Patricia Baird on heredity and your family, and on the lower portion, as a special service to new members, If anyone's going to 25th and Arbutus, there are some newcomers to Vancouver who would be very grateful for a ride. And I just hope that you'll stop at the membership table for the other usual purpose, too, on the way out.